Since 1947, the World Affairs Council has become the preeminent global stage for world leaders and the public to inform, engage, and debate the most important issues of our time. It's your world. Get to know it.
Well, good evening. You're so quiet, I'm going to take advantage of it. And I want to welcome you to tonight's program. You know, it's Cambodian Democracy and Human Rights Under Siege. Joining us this evening is Mu Sokhua, the Honorable Mu, member of the Cambodian Parliament. And I'd like to thank those of you who are from UC Berkeley School of Social Welfare, which is co-sponsoring the program tonight. I'd like to acknowledge those of you who are alumni who are in attendance for the evening. I'm Chuck Frankel. I'm a member of the board of the World Affairs Council, and I'm going to give you a quick word about the Council, though many of you are very familiar with it. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. If you want to learn more about the organization, you can go to our website, www.itsyourworld.org. If you're unable to attend a program, but you're interested in hearing it or watching it, the Council offers you two great ways to stay connected. You can either listen to the weekly radio show called It's Your World on KQED Radio on Monday evenings, or visit our website for audio and video recordings of past programs. Let me quickly announce two upcoming programs. On Wednesday, September 30th, you can meet and hear Kjell-Magne Bondevik. He is the former Prime Minister of Norway and the current president of the Oslo Center for Peace and Human Rights. President Bondevik will discuss his partnership with the former president of Iran, Mohammad Khatami, and how the two of them are working together to reduce tensions between Iran and the West. I'm not sure he's succeeding, but at least you'll hear what he's doing. This event will take place here in the Council Auditorium at 6:30 p.m., and that's September 30th. Then one other program that I think you'll be interested in on Wednesday, October 14th, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof will be here for a discussion on the global imperative for action on the empowerment of women. Mr. Kristof will explore the connections between economic progress and the unleashing of women's potential. This event will take place at the Fairmont Hotel, 6 p.m., October 14th. And finally, I think you found blue question cards on your chairs. Please write your questions clearly and succinctly, if you would, for Mu Sokhua, and hand them to the Council staff members. We will use your questions during the Q&A session in the latter half of our program. I think that there were some students who met with Ms. Mu earlier. I hope that they will write the questions and pass them up so I can ask questions that remained unanswered in the earlier session. A last reminder, turn off your cell phones, please, and anything else that might interrupt the program. And now it's my distinct honor to introduce tonight's speaker. Mu Sokhua is a member of the Cambodian Parliament, a pro-democracy campaigner, social worker, and women's rights advocate. She has played a critical role in the empowerment of women in Cambodia and has worked tirelessly to lead the fight against gender-based violence for more than 25 years. She graduated from the UC Berkeley School of Social Welfare in 1981, and after 18 years in exile, returned to Cambodia. In 1998, she was elected to the parliament and was Minister of Women's and Veterans Affairs until 2004, when she left the governing party and joined the opposition Sam Rainsy Party. Most recently, she attempted to sue Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen for defamation, but the court dismissed her suit and instead upheld the Prime Minister's counter-defamation lawsuit this past August. Ms. Mu was fined and her parliamentary immunity stripped in a court case that attracted the attention of the UN High Commission on Human Rights. In 2005, she was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for her efforts to stop the trafficking of women in the Cambodian and Thai sex trade. She joins us this evening for a discussion of her efforts to oppose sex trafficking, domestic violence, land grabs, and corruption in Cambodia. She has just come from testifying before members of Congress and meeting with Secretary Hillary Clinton and Ambassador-at-Large Melanie Verveer. She's about to return to Cambodia in a few days. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mu Sa Khua.
Good evening. I am very honored, very privileged to be here with you this evening at the World Affairs Council of San Francisco. I was at your Sacramento chapter 2 days ago. I wish I could invite you to the World Affairs Council of Cambodia in Phnom Penh. That is unlikely to happen soon. I look across in the room from here to there. I see faces that are attentive, that want to learn, want to know, want to get knowledge, because you cherish, you give importance to issues that transcend borders. And there are no issues that transcend borders better than human rights and democracy. And sadly, I have to say that human rights and democracy in Cambodia today are under siege. And sadly, I have to say, the road toward reconstructing, rebuilding Cambodia is a long way if we don't deal with this situation now, because there are clear signs, early signs enough, that Cambodia is moving and can be moving toward the situation as Burma, where it is now too late. I don't want to be Aung San Suu Kyi. There's no way to be compared to Aung San Suu Kyi. Therefore, I ask you, after this discussion, do not be here and listen and take notes, but to hear as concerned citizen of America, as concerned citizen of the world. Is that a promise? I look also around the room, and I wish that this could happen in Cambodia as well. People of all ages. That would not happen in Cambodia either, because our youth are deprived of their rights, deprived of this kind of opportunity to sit and listen with people from an older generation. And they, first of all, only 30% of our youth, or less than that, and with women it's less than 30% of our youth can go and finish high school. Less than 20% can go and to pursue higher education. That is totally opportunity lost. That is totally opportunity stolen from our youth. And I can go on and on and on about the lost opportunities. I can go on and on about the situation that we think that is a total sign that if we continue like this, Cambodia, democracy, in development in Cambodia is not going to be sustainable development. It's going to be worse than this. And as U.S. citizens, you should ask your government, what is your government doing with the $53 million that are spent in reconstructing Cambodia right now? You should also ask your government why $4.5 million are being spent to support the defense ministry in Cambodia when the major perpetrators of human rights, while the people who are behind the deforestation in Cambodia are the big generals. You should also ask tonight, send a letter to your Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, why the Minister of Defense from Cambodia is coming to Washington, D.C. And for sure, write a letter to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when she meets with the Foreign Minister of Cambodia the following questions. The following questions are that at this point, we have come 16 years together to build Cambodia, we meaning the Cambodian people. We have held four general elections. That for the government of Cambodia, for the Prime Minister of Cambodia, he is selling this as, see, there is democracy in Cambodia. Elections are held every 5 years. And very free, very fair, with little sign of violence. But elections are rigged from day one. The past election in 2008, about 1 million eligible voters could not register to vote. All their names were taken off the list. Even my name was taken off the list. I would have missed a chance to run as a candidate had I not gone to the commune office and searched for my name. And I have a master's degree. 80% of our people live in the rural areas. 36% of our people make less than 50 cents a day. 40 to 50% of our women don't read and write. And in order to go to the commune chief or commune office, they have to walk 3 to 4 kilometers. They can't do that. And the village chief is the one who identifies who can register to vote and who cannot register to vote. So in that sense, the way Cambodia is administered is very much the way the Khmer Rouge kept control of the lives of our people and killed 1.7 million, including my parents and many of my relatives. So the situation in Cambodia at this moment, in terms of freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of speech is pretty much close to nothing. Because the government is using the court to sue anybody. And when I say the government, I say mainly the Prime Minister. His power is reinforced by three things. One, because the people live in fear. We live in a culture of fear, total fear. It is like in the purple years. I keep repeating the purple years because there are signs that we are going back. Hopefully not to the purple years, but the setup now is very scary. In the purple years, people whisper to each other. And now we are whispering. If you are from the opposition party, you are not with the ruling party, you are identified. You are colored very quickly by the village chief, by the commune chief, by the district chief, by the local authorities. Even if you want to be, you are a civil servant, you have to be connected. You have to sign up as a member of the ruling party. Otherwise, you cannot be promoted in your, even as a teacher. Now I want to get into another issue, the freedom, why the Prime Minister keeps his power. How? The fear, level of fear that he keeps, he controls. Second, he is selling Cambodia to the West. And the West looks and think of Cambodia as a peaceful country. When you think of Cambodia today, what do you see in your mind? What do you think of it? What do you think? You see Angkor Wat. You see the beauty of Cambodia. How many of you have visited Cambodia? Mm. Yeah. And when you were there, what did you see? The beauty, right? The rice fields. No more killing fields. So the Cambodian government, especially the Prime Minister, compares and tells us to think. You compare Cambodia today with the killing fields. That's not a good comparison. We want to compare Cambodia with the evolution, with the development in Vietnam, for example. There are statistics that tell us that Cambodia is not doing well. In Vietnam, of 1,000 babies born in a year, first year. In Cambodia, 90 of these babies die within a year. In Laos, a country that is even less developed than Cambodia, 56 of these babies die. Okay? In Vietnam, 16. In Thailand, 6. And in America, even one is, you see it all over TV. Right? So we want to compare Cambodia with at least to the development in Vietnam, our neighboring countries. We would not want to compare today to the development, the quality of life in the U.S. But the Prime Minister wants to compare Cambodia to the Khmer Rouge years so that the people who live below poverty line can say, well, this is what we get. It's pretty good. In the Khmer Rouge years, we could not even eat. Right now, we have roads, we have airplanes, and so on and so on. So the Prime Minister keeps under control what he wants, or the government, what he wants, they want to put out to the people. So under control is the media. Under his control, the opposition party or his critics. So three things. One, keep control of the lives of the people through the village chief and so on. Two, the media and 3 sell Cambodia to the West as a success story. But I think at this point, the success story is no longer the in Cambodian proverb. You say there is a saying that goes, "You cannot hide a dead elephant with a lotus leaf." The elephant now is dead. The lotus leaf cannot hide this elephant, because even if you can hide the big elephant, the smell of the dead elephant is too gross. And we make sure that you smell the smell of this dead elephant, and that's why I am here. And by being here, I am in huge trouble. On top of my case in court. We support you. You support me. I thank you very much. So with that, I conclude my remarks by saying, in one word, Cambodia is not a poor country. Cambodia is a very rich country. Our people of peace, but we have lost our soul because of a nation that development policies that are not pro-poor, pro-people, but pro-tycoons, pro-rich. Thank you.
And now, of course, we turn to questions, and I want to encourage you to write some questions and pass them up. I'll start by asking, you testified before a Human Rights Commission in Washington, and what did you seek from the U.S.? What is it you think that the U.S. can do to be helpful?
I asked for different things, but I asked from your Congress to send a delegation of a congressional delegation, high level, to go to Cambodia and speak, bring to the table the Speaker of the House and the leader of the opposition. Because in Parliament, we have 26 seats out of 123 seats. We have no power, no position whatsoever in Parliament. The 9 parliamentary commissions belong to the party of the Prime Minister. We are not even members of these commissions. At the Commission on Human Rights, the commission in the United States, the commission is co-chaired by both parties. There are 8 commission members. They are equally divided by parties. In our country, in the parliament in Cambodia today, we have nothing. That's why when they want to lift our immunity, they just call the commission members, the commissioners, and then they put this forward on as an agenda, and they get the members of parliament. They got 90 seats, and the members of parliament don't speak at all, because if they talk, they lose their seats. You see, it's because it's the party. It is the party that determines who sit, who can be changed. It's not elected by the people. Even if after you're elected by the people, your party can take you out of your seat anytime. You see, so we are asking a high delegation from the Congress to come and help negotiate in Parliament, so that we can have some kind of so there is a level playing field in the National Assembly. And on top, and in addition to that, we as members of parliament, we want to be able to fulfill our role to serve our people without fear of prosecution. We are asking that from the Congress and from the U.S. government. We are asking that the U.S. put in money right away into the electoral process and not wait till election day. That would be too late. We are asking your government to check on the military, to put visa sanctions on those high-ranking officials whose names are on the corruption list. Cambodia loses $500 million per year to corruption. And 4,000 women in Cambodia lose their lives by giving birth at the same time. And we can go on and on. Teachers in Cambodia make less than $2 a day. At the same time, Cambodia is losing $500 million to corruption. The gap between the rich and the poor is so wide. So we are asking the U.S. to reassess its policy on aid to Cambodia.
You mentioned putting money into elections. I assume you don't mean buying votes. How do they do that?
How do they buy votes? It's so easy.
No, how does the U.S. put money into elections?
First, I want to say how they buy votes, too.
That's a different class.
They buy votes by keeping the people poor. You see? Okay, the electoral process in Cambodia, first you start with the National Election Committee. It has to be independent. It has to be neutral. But the members and the president of the National Assembly, the vice president of the National Election Committee, belong to the ruling party. The ruling party has control of all the media. We in opposition cannot be on TV. We can be on some radio stations, well, Radio Free Asia and Voice of America. Yeah, I asked the U.S. to put in money today so that Voice of America and Radio Free Asia can have televised programs to give information, balanced information, to the people so that they can start get better right information so that when it is the day to make the choice on the election day, they can make that right choice, the choice that is formed through balanced information.
You sought, I think, additional help from the U.S. through funding of the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute. If that funding is provided, would those institutions be permitted to operate in Cambodia?
The two institutions are already in Cambodia. They've been in Cambodia for almost 10 years. However, the situation in the political situation is not conducive. That's why we have to, the U.S. should not be the only government to work on the electoral process or to reassess its their policy on Cambodia. The U.S. must join the EU. The U.S. must ask Japan, the Japanese government, which is a new government now, to be together to counterbalance the investments of China. Investment of China that puts no ties to human rights and democracy. But it does not mean, the problem is that the donor community seems to have a different approach and does not give the right, a strong, a firm message to the government.
You lived in the United States for many years and then returned to Cambodia. What were your first reactions to being back in Cambodia? Do you remember that?
I left the U.S. to go work in the camps 1 week in the border camps in Cambodia, in Thailand. 1 week after I got my citizenship, 1 week after I graduated from UC Berkeley, I see my former bosses here on the front row shaking their heads. Yes, because when I was here, I was so anxious to go back home. And finally, I got to go home. But after 18 years in exile and traveling outside of Cambodia, where I went back in 1989, I left Cambodia when I was 18 years old in 1972. I went back in 1989 with two young children, one of four years and one of 2 years. There was no electricity. There were ox carts on the road. I couldn't. The house I grew up in were occupied by other families. And that was the situation then. So if you go, now 16 years later, yes, there has been progress. We're not saying there's no progress at all. My children, now we have three children, were raised in Cambodia, went to the international school, has the top education, private school. Yes, there is progress. But the progress can be, but our people deserve better than this. If there were no corruption, if the government is less oppressive, we're not asking for your kind of government. Well, that's dangerous here. We're talking about some freedom of speech. Where I'm sure if we were to open up the healthcare issue policy here, there would be a debate, right? And then afterwards, you would go and chat and have wine together. In my country, it's not it. You kill each other. Or the government will say, ha, this person is from the opposition. Let's get them.
Could you talk a little bit about women's issues, the whole gamut, that is women's rights today, how men react to women members of parliament, talk a bit about prostitution, and the government's position on these issues.
There is a proverb in Cambodia that says, men are gold and women are just a white piece of cloth. You know, gold, when it is dropped in mud, it's still gold. You pick it up, you wash off the mud, it is even more shiny, right? But a piece of white cloth, here's your piece of white cloth. If it is tainted even with just one drop of black ink, here you go, it's tainted forever. Which means that women who are sold in prostitution, women who are battered, or women like me who don't follow the norms, we are tainted. We are no longer a white piece of cloth. So when I became Minister for Women's Affairs, I changed the proverb. I said, okay, men can be gold, but women are precious gems. And with that, we ran these women precious gems. We made the Prime Minister wear the precious gems pin. We campaigned as a minister. I would go on ox carts. I would go on boats, rivers, and so on, walk and say, women are precious gems. Women are precious gems. We even had a song. But the singer who sang the song was paralyzed, was shot and paralyzed from the waist down. She's now in San Jose. Because And then there's no, the perpetrator was never found because of the culture of impunity. So if you go too far, you are punished because of the culture of impunity and because of poverty. And poverty, yes, poverty is even worse when you have to sell your land, you have to sell your cows, your children, because you can't get access to health care. That is such a high level, intolerable level of injustice. And by when we talk about women's rights, we cannot just say Cambodian women want to be liberated. We're talking about the most basic things. We're talking about having access to healthcare, having access to education, having the decent housing, and so on. You know, today, 70,000 women who have just been laid off from the garment factories, many of them are entering the entertainment world sector. And when we talk about the entertainment sector in Cambodia, we're not talking about ballet, fine arts and all that. We're talking about women who go to massage parlors to work, who serve men beer in beer gardens, or sing in karaoke's because they have to support their families, or they are sold. And can you imagine the level of violence, the risk that our women take? And that's why in the context of all of that, we put it in the context of human rights and democracy. So my case, by talking about my case, I am not talking about my case. I am talking about the situation of human rights and democracy in Cambodia, so that those who do not have a voice have a voice. I am going to jail, not because I enjoy going to jail. I chose to go to jail because I want to put the judiciary in Cambodia on trial.
You have had very special opportunity being able to run and win a seat in Parliament, a position that few women have attained. I think there were only two women in Parliament. Is that right?
No, there were two women in government. There are 27 government. Women in Parliament.
Aha, two women in the cabinet.
Yes.
But one of the members of the audience asks, even if you're able, if human trafficking is eliminated, will women ever have equal opportunities, and how will they ever be considered equals in Cambodia?
If you speak about, that's why we have to, that's why the whole thing is about human rights and democracy. And that's why we can't lower the standard for human rights. Because we are talking about, first of all, addressing basic rights of people. And if our women, if there is still such a high level of corruption, how can we reach our people? How can we provide, especially our women, the basic rights, the basic services? The quality of care. I'm not even talking about quality of care. That's the next step. I'm just talking about getting them to the hospital. You know, when you go to the hospital in Cambodia, they ask you first, how much can you pay? Yeah, here you ask, do you have an insurance? Right? No. And we are talking about education. With that, we have to equip our women. We have to equip our women with education, with health, with a healthy body, healthy mind, in order to negotiate with their husbands in bed. inside the home, or the man who buy the go to the brothels. The more you keep the women uneducated, the least power. And we are talking about that. We're talking about social justice. If we don't put social justice first, we can't negotiate with culture, with the norms. Because without a voice, without a presence, without political clout, how can our women make change? And that's why in my work, we and in my party, we are very clear. I'm the president of the women's wing of my party. We are making our promises to our women that we look for women to run, and we raise money to support the candidacy. We make that commitment. And it starts also with a political party that is democratic, that is committed, and we are accountable to the people. And by talking, by showing ourselves at the front, at the doorstep of the houses, by walking each village, we make ourselves seen, heard, and known. And we say, you know us. You can ask for us to help you. But at the same time, that means that you don't have to vote for us if you don't believe in us. We cannot give you a bag of rice. And we will not buy votes, because that destroys the future of your children, the future of Cambodia. So as we defend, we talk, we also are talking about very simple concept like corruption, very simple concept. Oh, wait, concept is not simple, like rule of law. How can you there are many fancy words in Cambodian, and then we pick up these words from, and this concept from the West as well. And some of these words cannot be translated into Cambodian, like transparency, accountability, rule of law. These words don't exist. We have to create these words. And you can't imagine our women who don't read and write. What does that mean? I sell my vote. That's better. At least today, I have 50 kilos of rice. Forget about tomorrow.
You mentioned corruption. You do have a word for corruption. And
Pukroloy.
And what does that mean?
Pukroloy means Pukroloy. It's rotten to the core. Pukroloy.
And can you tell us a little bit about corruption? What does that mean in Cambodia? Who is it? Business? Is it for
at
politics?
All levels.
So see, talk about a typical situation. You could.
If you want to register your children to school, you go see the village chief. You go see the commune chief, and then you pay a fee. And then you ask for a receipt, he laughs at you. What receipt? He pockets that. So it's that level of corruption. So people accept it. You are sick. You are poor. You want to be identified as the poorest of the poor in your commune, in your village, so that the Red Cross, which is totally controlled by the First Lady, by the way, can give you assistance. The village chief say, okay, are you a member of our party? Oh, you get 50 kilos of rice, but you give me 25 kilos as my share. You go to the court, even the clerk asks you, how much can you pay? Literally, when I was minister, I caught I went to court. When I was minister, I would go to the brothels, I would go to police station, I would go to court just to see how, and to hospitals, just to see how real life is all about. And you know what they do? They put the cases by a row, and then they bid. The judges, the prosecutors bid on these cases. Let's say you specialize in white crime, for example. You bid on the white crime because it pays a lot, and you don't have enough money to bid, Bob, as a judge. You bid on small cases. You see? And I was there. And this woman came up to me, gave me her business card, and she said, "Hey, you want to bid?" I said, "Bid what?" "We have prostitution cases of traffickers. I specialize." This she tells me, "I specialize on trafficking. Bid, you want to bid?" That's the situation in Cambodia. And then let's not talk about big companies that go to sign contracts. Now we have oil, we have minerals. Sign contracts under the table. So it's that big, big money. Corruption is everywhere, everywhere. We breathe it. We live with it. And that has to be stopped. And that cannot be stopped only when people take action. And we people are trying to take action. There was a petition of about 1 million thumbprints. The people took these petitions to court, to the Prime Minister's office, to the National Assembly. They were rejected. Because there's not evidence of corruption here. How can you find evidence of corruption if the witnesses are not even protected? Who dares talk about corruption, especially at the highest level? Right now, the publisher of this paper, who is pro-democracy, is in jail because he covered one small corruption case. It goes on and on and on.
We've talked a little bit about your trial in court and the fact that the Prime Minister sued you in return and that you were found guilty. Can you talk a little bit more about what you were bringing against the Prime Minister and what your present situation is and what happens when you return to Cambodia?
To cut it short, the Prime Minister called me a hustler. He says that I go around and grab men and take off my shoes in public. So I sued him. I sued him. He sued me back the same day, and he sued my lawyer the same day. And the Cambodian Bar Association threatened to disbar my lawyer. I lost in court, lower court. I did not accept it. I am appealing my case. And you think I will win? Then I'm going to go to Supreme Court. You think I will win? Then the Prime Minister says, and they're saying it right now in Cambodia every day, "You see, she can't go to court. She refuses to have a lawyer. We gave her a lawyer." But fair trial means a lawyer of your own choosing. I'm not going to get a lawyer that is given to me that works for the Prime Minister's office. You see? So, if I'm fine, I am fine. And then the Prime Minister says, his lawyer says, she should be charged on 4 counts. The prosecutor says, she should be charged on 4 counts, the same 4 counts. And then the judge repeated, announced the exact four counts with no investigation, nothing at all. That's it. You're found guilty. So I am not going to pay not even one dime. Because if I pay, that means I admit guilt. In front of my people, especially the women who are raped every day, who are sold every day, if I were to admit my guilt, what kind of hope will they have? How can I return home? So I am a member of parliament with no immunity. I have been found guilty. When I stepped off the airplane on Wednesday, I could be arrested anytime. So sooner or later, I go to jail. But I will continue to speak. How? Through you. I hope you won't let me stay in jail for 16 years as Aung San Suu Kyi. The longest is 6 months. I have talked with my children, my family. I prepared myself that 6 months in jail, that's the price I have to pay for democracy. That's not a high price. I go to jail.
You started out in Parliament as a member of the governing party, and then you switched to the opposition. What did you see? Why did you switch after having been in the ruling party for several years?
Corruption. I could not continue to serve a government, but to sit with members of cabinet and a prime minister that I know are stealing the money from my people, from their people. I just could not.
Land grabbing. Tell us a little bit about what's going on and how the Cambodian people can overcome land grabbing in your country.
It breaks my heart to talk about land grab because I see farmers, I see women in Cambodia, the beautiful rice fields of Cambodia, kneeling down, begging the military to give them back their land. Because I know that innocent villagers are in jail right now because they stand up to defend their land. 30% of Cambodia's forest are lost already. 3 concessions and concessions and concessions for in the name of economic development, and now free economic zone, and now mining. It's just land taken away. Land taken away from everywhere, especially at north in the mountains, where our minorities live for generations of land, of the forest, the land, the ancestors. And they bury the ancestors and the land. And to them it's sacred. But they are forced by gun, the power of the gun. And they are put in jail. When the forest is gone, the women have no longer have the herbs, the leaves that they depend on for medicine. And it goes on and on and on. That's why one of the witnesses at the testimony in hearing last week spoke about land. Please go Google Global Witness. There are 2 reports that talk about the forests in Cambodia and how they are destroyed. And then we talk about the land issue, and the report is called Cambodia, a Country for Sale. And you can read all the reports. The UN reports talk about nothing but land issues, the lack of independence in the judiciary, and the silencing of the opposition party. And corruption is in the report of the World Bank.
There are today many different multilateral organizations and non-governmental organizations, nonprofits that are operating in Cambodia. Are they making the situation better, or are they making it worse?
Better in some sense. Worse if they are apart. They are worse, like the Chinese companies, South Korean companies that continue to pay the bribes. But without international organizations, the donors, the NGOs, our people would be in much greater need for services. Cambodia is quite open. The government keeps it open. Again, it's a part of the facade for democracy. But now the government wants to have an NGO law to control the non-governmental organizations. So what is important is that you continue to go into Cambodia, but also to speak. And the NGOs, if they are out of Cambodia, we will then walk very fast toward the situation as in Burma. That's why we are not asking for, we are asked if the next step, if the situation on human rights gets worse than this, then we will ask the U.S. to give money through NGOs only and take it from the government, and we will not ask for a cut of aid because that will be punishing the poor.
Are there significant ethnic tensions within Cambodia?
No.
Is there any problem related to people who have specifically Chinese heritage?
No, I'm part Chinese. You can tell from the way I look and from my name. We are in parliament, we are in government. No, this. That's why I'm saying that Cambodia can be much better than this. We have no ethnic conflicts. We have no more war. We have our natural resources. We don't have to be a country of beggars. And the people are, we are people of peace. We don't want to go back to war. We have had enough.
And I think we have reached the end, but we have a final question for you. One of the members of the audience wants a little bit of history to put what you have said in context. When did the current prime minister first take office, and how has the government been able to stay in office for such a long time?
The first real free and fair elections after the war was held in 1993 with the aid of the United Nations. The prime minister's party lost the election. The Royalist Party won the election. But the prime minister's party refuses to hand over the power to the Royalist Party. And the king, King Sihanouk at the time, negotiated for a sharing of power by having co-premiership. Cambodia was the only country government in the world that has co-premiership. And by having co-premiership, the Royalist Party was also so tempted by power and corruption and sold off this and got involved in corruption fast. And the prime minister's party had control of the whole situation. There was a coup in 1997, then he finally took over. And there was no longer co-premiership. He became the prime minister.
This is Hun Sen.
Yes. There's only one prime minister since 1993 in Hun Sen. And then he said, and then every 5 years, yes, we have election, but it's totally rigged. And then he says he will continue to be prime minister until the day he dies. He's only 57 years old.
Well, we are all amazed at your courage, and we all support your success when you return. We are all thinking of you, and obviously we thank you very much for participating tonight. So on behalf of both the World Affairs Council and UC Berkeley School of Social Welfare, thanks much to Musa Koa for providing us with a wonderful evening.
Allow me to repeat my request. It's for you when you go back to your computer tonight. Write to Hillary Clinton. Write to your Secretary of Defense, Secretary Gates, and I am on Facebook. Let's stay, remain in touch. Thank you.
Thank you.